I'd like to welcome everyone to this talk. And of course, COVID being COVID, the drills just started outside my house. So please forgive me, and we will move forward. Thank you all so much for coming. Just so you know, this will be recorded. So please be aware of that. And also, as you have questions, if you would please put them in the chat function. And at the end of the presentations, we will have Q&A. But if you would put them in the chat, that would be terrific. So again, thank you all for coming. And I'd like to thank the hosts of this event, of course, the London School of Economics and the Department of History, the University of East London, and the Columbia University Department of History. I'd also very much like to thank all of our participants, Michael Reynolds, Michelle Goldman, Paula Larson, Mary Duziak, and Laura Spinney. The way this came about was in a kind of non-COVID discussion between myself and Michael Reynolds, just a Zoom call, and he said, well, how do things end? And he said, Laura Spinney must have that answer. From there, it snowballed into this wonderful presentation. And I knew Mary's work on time and thought that she would be the perfect opening to this discussion, particularly in time and war. And of course, her other work. So I am so pleased to welcome you all. I will introduce Michael, he is going to introduce the panelists. They will give their talks, and then we'll have time for Q&A. And please do feel free to put questions in the chat box as people are speaking, and I'll aggregate the questions and we'll go from there. So with that, I'd like to introduce Michael Reynolds. He is a visiting senior fellow at the Department of International History at the London School of Economics, and also the course leader in the International Law Program at the University of East London. He is a lawyer and practicing international arbiter. His new book will be published in July, Instruments of Peacemaking, 1870 to 1914, and it deals with international disputes that were resolved by diplomats and lawyers applying international law. And so with that, I will hand it off to Michael.
Thank you very much indeed, Victoria. It's my great pleasure to introduce Mary Duziak, Asa Biggs Chandler Professor of Law at Emory University. She is a leading legal historian and United States and World Scholar. She's past president of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations and an honorary profession fellow of the American Society for Legal History. She's the author of Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences, published by Oxford University Press in 2012, and other works. Her latest book, forthcoming in June 2021, is Making the Forever War, Marilyn Young on the Politics and Culture of American War. That's published by the University of Massachusetts Press, 2021, co-edited with Mark Bradley. She is currently writing about the decline in democratic restraint of United States war powers. Her research has been supported by the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and others. Laura Spinney is a well-known writer and science journalist. Her writing on science has appeared in The Guardian newspaper, The Economist, Nature and National Geographic, amongst others. She is the author of two novels, The Doctor, published in 2013, her best-selling nonfiction account of the 1918 influenza pandemic, Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918,
So I thank you, Michael Reynolds, for that generous introduction. And thank you so much, Maria, for including me. And to everyone who is here, I'm so honored to be on this panel with my distinguished co-panelists. So I am going to just start off actually by talking about endings as a concept, as endings are the idea of an ending is in part a temporal concept, right? An ending is thought of as a break in time, so that there is a before and an after. Pandemic time and wartime have certain things in common. They're both thought of as a departure from normal time. And so the hope or the fantasy, the idea, is that once their time period has passed, then we sort of go back to normal. So wartime thinking, I think, is helpful for how we might think about the way that endings to the pandemic might be conceptualized. And I have at the end sort of some ideas for how I think ending wartime and in peacetime. So the end of war is therefore in this conceptualization when peacetime law and politics return. So because of this kind of thinking, endings have consequences. And this is why actually a man named Khalid Qasim, 44 years old from Yemen, has just sued the United States. He's been held in the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo for 19 years without a trial or a sentence. Until now, the United States could argue that it was lawful to detain him as a military combatant until the end of the war in which he fought against the United States. So the idea is you can detain an enemy combatant without charges, just hold them during a war, and then they get released when the war is over. So President Biden just called for an end to the war in Afghanistan. If wartime has ended, the justification for detaining Qasim would seem to have evaporated. Let the man go. So what kind of ending, however, is happening in Afghanistan? Well, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said recently that the mission was ending. However, we are still going to maintain counterterrorism capabilities in the region. So what does that mean? We've seen endings like this before. On August 18th, 2010, the war in Iraq ended live on NBC. It was a historic moment, claimed MSNBC reporters, even though the image on camera was not of an armistice being signed, but of a long line of military vehicles crossing the border, military vehicles crossing the border into Kuwait. President Barack Obama christened the moment as historic with a televised address about with the end of the conflict. Soldiers were still deployed, however, in what looked to them like a war zone, and they were doing warlike tasks under fire. So questions immediately arose. Were they still going to get combat service medals? What about their hostile fire pay? So the Army responded, yes, of course, all of that would continue. The war had ended, the Pentagon explained, but combat conditions are still prevalent. The new mission essentially meant that a different title was given to the medals that they were awarded for doing the same tasks they did before the purported end of the war. So wartime and peacetime are not stable categories. And one thing that's lost in all the fuzziness is political accountability for endless war. Americans have to be told about when their wars end. So this media moment and the argument that it's an end of a war, because most Americans don't experience war directly. War is for most Americans a distant abstraction. And this has been the case for much longer than it's been the experience in Europe, for example. This has been the U.S. experience all through the 20th century, that war is over there. So war is something that American civilians really have no purchase on. Well, an attendee at one of my talks objected to this idea that war is somewhere else, and so the civilian population doesn't understand it. We understand war, he said. We've seen Saving Private Ryan, essentially making my point that war is seen by Americans through the movies. And so this enables this, government attempt to create an argument about war ending, and the American public needing it to be explained to them, you know, whether war is happening or whether it's not. Now, COVID-19 might seem to be the opposite of this problem of distant war, and so essentially the government having much more of a purchase on the narrative and the timing, the sort of how the timing is described. So COVID-19 would be the opposite, right? Everyone has been vulnerable to the danger. It's up close and personal. I actually thought at the beginning that it would generate in the United States what Drew Gilpin Faust, thinking of the Civil War, called a republic of suffering, a culture brought together in grief. I was, of course, deeply wrong about this. I actually have an essay about this that will be out in June. But COVID has generated a time period, even though it may not have been the time period that we would have expected. We might think of, and I'm sure my colleagues will say more about this, you know, speaking knowledgeably about the science, but, you know, we might think of the cells of the virus as the catalyst for the initial break, the onset of the pandemic, with an invisible life form shutting down the social life of humans. What happens thereafter, however, I think has more to do with culture and politics. Like war, the pandemic has a geography, of course, globally and within countries. The dying is mostly in the United States, is mostly in healthcare facilities. And when bodies have overwhelmed the morgues, they have been neatly stored away from view. And so the experience of the carnage within the United States has been highly sanitized. Deaths are represented. We see them mostly in numbers. Historian Jacqueline Wernemont, writing of the 17th century plague, explains the way the path of the disease then becomes the story. Numbers are thought to show something bigger than the individual experience. They show a view of the whole. But in aggregating the dead, she writes, it rendered them meaningless to the state as individual humans in their own moment, the moment of their death. By aggregating the dead, having lost their individuality, the COVID-19 dead have then become a public policy tool. As numbers, they can motivate behavior like mask wearing and social distancing. The numbers terrorize when they rise and generate relief when they fall. Mourning then is largely replaced with the desire for self-protection from being a number. So the most consequential geography of COVID is, of course, the division between countries with healthcare resources and those without, as we can see right now with what's happening in India. There is a clamor for return to normalcy in the United States as catastrophic conditions tear through parts of the global South, and even as it rages through individual states. So I expect that there will be several kinds of endings in light of all of this, of the COVID-19 pandemic. There will be numbers-driven endings. Charts will appear to zero out. But some people will point at the charts and say that it is an ending. But the very construction of charts requires an erasure of aspects of social and material life. So this ending may be most significant for the charts makers and the charts users, the public policy folks. And, you know, one of the things excluded from the charts in the United States is even what's happening in Canada and Mexico, contiguous countries. There will be, look for this, an end of the Iraq War version, a political event, perhaps motivated by a desire to aid the economy, but with dubious ties to the state of the virus itself. And I expect to be a dominant experience within the United States. Globally, you know, I just think about all of the works on 1945 and the difference in the works between the U.S. experience of 1945 and the experience in Europe, Asia, and elsewhere that were war zones. It was a transition to economic growth in the United States, where the destruction of the war itself had not ravaged the infrastructure and civilian population. And then there's Europe and Asia, where the landscape of World War II carnage deeply shaped social life in the new era, which was not an era apart from the war. 1945 could be experienced as a clean break in the United States, a new form of time. For countries in the wartime, endings were simultaneously beginnings, and the messy end-beginning era was essentially a landscape of destruction in which past deeply structured a new present. So if there is an after to this era, you know, warning, look for the Iraq War version, but perhaps it would be better to have a global view and to have the sort of Europe-Asia version of 1945. They're moving ahead to see us all as moving ahead in a devastated landscape, for there has been simply too much death to imagine a future that is not deeply imbricated with loss.
Thank you so much, Mary. That was just wonderful. Laura.
My turn. Thanks, Vicky. And thank you, Mary, for setting the scene so powerfully. So I think you kind of expressed the idea that sometimes our lived reality doesn't have anything in common with the historical chronology that's imposed on us. And I think that's something that wars and pandemics can have in common. And thinking about the period where I was working when I was doing my research for my book, World War One, I mean, it's by no stretch of the imagination ended at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month. In fact, by a sort of tragic irony, 11,000, to continue the train of 11s, 11,000 men are estimated to have died or been injured or gone missing on that day alone, which is more than on D-Day in 1944. The armistice had to be renewed four times before the Treaty of Versailles was signed, and demobilization went on until 1920. And if I'm talking about the war rather than the pandemic, which is my subject, it's because they are closely entangled and they shaped each other and they shaped each other's duration. In fact, the fact that the demobilization was a powerful vehicle for the dissemination of the virus as the men went back to the four corners of the world. So they are tangled up. And I think that there are differences, though, that pandemic time is different from wartime, perhaps because the other party, the enemy, if you like, doesn't have the same concept or any concept of time. So to go now to the subject of the 1918 pandemic, the first official cases were recorded on the 4th of March 1918 in Kansas, but we don't know where it started, and we are absolutely certain that it started earlier than that. It washed over the world in three waves, of which the most lethal was the second wave, but those waves did not strike every part of the world, and they struck different parts of the world at different times. So in the southern hemisphere, they tended to strike later than in the northern hemisphere. The vast majority, so we think that the 1918 pandemic killed between 50 and 100 million people globally. The vast majority of those deaths occurred in the blink of an eye, 13 weeks between the middle of September and the middle of December 1918. But that was not the end, because in the Northern Hemisphere, the third wave would then strike in the early months of 1919. It wasn't so bad as the second wave, but it interfered, for example, with the peace conference in Paris. You could say that the pandemic was essentially over by the summer of 1918 in Europe and the United States, but it continued to rage elsewhere, and it was still raging, for example, in the Pacific Islands and New Caledonia in July of 1921. So did it end there? That's one possible ending you could give it, but you could also think of it in the way that Mary suggested by looking at the charts. So one thing that we know that flu does is that flu, which is a very changeable, mutable virus, new strains tend to emerge. They tend to be very vicious. They cause pandemics, and then over time they become more benign. They moderate their virulence, and they turn into eventually seasonal flus, which circulate and cause periodic outbreaks. That's what's happened in 1918. But it took time for it to make that change, to make that transformation. And one way you can think about it is that seasonal flu tends to have what we call a U-shaped mortality curve. So it's the very young and the very old are the most vulnerable. 1918 pandemic had a W-shaped mortality curve, roughly speaking, which meant that the very young, the very old, and a middle-aged group of the 20 to 40-year-olds were very vulnerable. So what happened in the years between, let's say, 1918 and 1928, took a decade, is that the W bottomed out in a U. You could think of that as the sort of taming of the pandemic strain as it became seasonal. So, okay, so if we think of it that way, we could say that the pandemic ended in 1928. Or we could say that it ended in 1957, because that strain that caused the pandemic and then became benign and more seasonal continued to circulate in the global population until 1957, causing periodic outbreaks until it was ousted by the newly emerging strain in that year that caused the 1957 pandemic of flu, so-called Asian flu. So here's another way you could think about it. Flu tends to be, we think of it as an acute disease, respiratory disease, rather like COVID, but like COVID, it can also be a chronic disease. So it can have long-term consequences, for example, but not limited to psychiatric consequences. We know that a wave of melancholia, depression, washed over the world in the wake of the 1918 pandemic. We have very few numbers on it, but we know it was everywhere. There's one interesting study actually from Norway. Norway is always interesting in this context because it was neutral in the war. So it allows you to separate the effects of the war and the pandemic. Unfortunately, this study is still not published. I wrote about it in my book in 2017. It's still not published. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it's interesting and a powerful indication of what happened anyway. So a demographer called Sven Erik Mameland looked at the admissions to psychiatric asylums in his country, Norway, between 1872 and 1929. And he found that for every year in which there was no flu pandemic, there were some admissions of mental illness related to flu. But in the 6 years following the 1918 pandemic, the average number of admissions each year was seven times higher than in those non-pandemic years. And he thinks that was probably, many caveats associated with his finding, because we don't know what those people were suffering from. We can't say for sure that it was linked to the flu. But what he thinks we're looking at is a wave of a sort of post-viral syndrome that came after us. And it was probably the tip of the iceberg, because most people wouldn't have gone to see a doctor at that time if they felt melancholic. Here's another way we can think about it. People who were in their mother's wombs at the time that the Spanish flu, 1918 flu, sometimes known as the Spanish flu, struck, were a diminished generation, if they were lucky enough to survive. Pregnant women were very vulnerable to that flu. So we know that as they grew older, they were affected both physically and psychologically. As adults, they were less likely to graduate and to earn a reasonable wage. They were more likely to go to prison to claim disability benefit and to suffer from heart disease after the age of 60. And if you think about the fact that their lifespan, that generation, has only recently passed, you could think about the 1918 flu as having cast a very long shadow indeed. There's also, by the way, there was another epidemic that struck the world, pandemic that struck the world in the early 20s, that of encephalitis lethargica, or sleepy sickness, as it was known colloquially. There is still a debate, started in the 1920s, still going on today, as to whether that was linked to the 1918 flu, whether it triggered the 1918 flu triggered this neurological condition in some patients. It affected 1 million people worldwide. About a third of them are thought to have died, a third of them recovered relatively quickly, and a third went on to develop a condition that resembled sort of advanced Parkinson's disease. This is the population of patients that Oliver Sacks wrote about in his famous book, Awakenings. So you could think of that potentially as an extension and as a continuation of the pandemic. As I say, the link hasn't been proven. But if it's a live question, and if it were to be, then you'd have to think of that as a continuation of the pandemic. So what about COVID? Well, people are talking busily at the moment about how it will pan out, what the future holds. There's one school of thought that the crisis phase that we're in now will perhaps be over by the end of this year, at least in the global north, perhaps not in the developing world, because there you have an insidious combination of new variants and a slow vaccine rollout, which is generating the catastrophe that Mary talked about. We've discussed this elusive concept of herd immunity, the idea that if you can reach a certain threshold of vaccination or of natural immunity in the population, the whole population is protected. I think the thinking now is pretty much that this is going to be quite difficult to achieve because of the new variants. And even if we do get there, it will be fleeting. That is, we may need booster vaccinations because of evolution of the virus and of just dropping off in immunity. So one scenario is that that we see seasonal waves of a milder form of this virus going forward, and that these get more benign over time, perhaps more spaced out in time, and that gradually we reach a sort of a kind of equilibrium where COVID is a sort of endemic disease. It might be something like flu, which would be bad because flu is a dangerous disease every year, and we don't really want another one of those. But it could be something that might be considered milder, more of an irritant, something like one of the other coronaviruses that cause the common cold. And in fact, really interestingly, at the moment, the pandemic that preceded the so-called Spanish flu, the one we call the Russian flu of the 1890s, although it's not clear that it started in Russia, is now in the middle of being reinterpreted. There's a theory from a Belgian group of researchers, in fact, that has been taken quite seriously, that it might not have been a flu at all. It might have been one of the coronaviruses that now circulates causing the common cold, and that might have been the spillover event when it first entered the human population from cows. And then, of course, COVID is not just a respiratory disease like the flu. We have long COVID. We're just beginning to understand that. Could be a very long shadow indeed. And then there's the economic fallout of this pandemic is another consequence to think about. So that's the reality, at least as we speculate about it at the moment. But as Mary said, we will also impose our own artificial endings on this pandemic. And in a way, we have to. There are practical reasons why we need to. We need to bring furlough schemes to an end because we can't afford to pay those forever. We need to revoke special measures and emergency powers. And we have to signal to the people that it's time to, you know, this is time to go back, you're safe. You know, and there are some practical reasons that we need to do that. But maybe it won't be the same moment in every country. That would be perfectly predictable because the pandemic is not striking different countries. We're not on the same curve and we're not having the same experience. And that will be a clue to future historians that these are, in fact, artificial ending points. And that, you know, when you look at the thing globally, it didn't really end that way. Or you can think about it at least in different ways. And I think in some parts of the world also, there might be a much less distinct sense of an ending at all. So, you know, in the global north where we're not so used to epidemics, we have a very clear sense, at least locally, of when our epidemic began. And I think we'll have quite a clear idea of when it ended locally. But in some parts of the world, for example, in some parts of Africa, it's just seen as the continuation of an old and unremitting problem. And I just wanted to quote two anthropologists who wrote a fascinating paper on this theme about Kenya last July, Wenzel Geisler and Ruth Prince of the University of Oslo, who wrote that people in this region have experienced a long century of epidemics and anti-epidemic measures of varying duration and intensity. For them, it was just one long thing. And so I think that I will stop there. I'm going to end with one of the most famous last lines ever, the last line of F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, since I think it speaks to my theme, both of endings and of their historical shaping and meaning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Laura. Now we'll move to Paula, please. I'm sorry, to Michelle, excuse me.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation. You know, as a physician, as a physician and a researcher, I feel a bit lost, but not completely. So I will try to build on what I heard so far, especially from Laura. And I think that if we think about the similarity and the difference, I would like perhaps to start, because I'm a scientist by training, by considering the role of science and scientists. And as you know, during the war, scientists are used by the politicians, the leaders, to help them to achieve their objectives. And I think that they are not so prominent. I mean, here, clearly, scientists have been at the forefront since the very beginning. And I think that we can criticize many of the players in the pandemic. But if you look at science, it has been an incredible success. I mean, when you see what scientists were able to achieve within a few weeks to identify the virus, within less than a year to produce and deploy vaccines. And there are certain types of treatments which are now available. And perhaps the last example I will try to I will use to illustrate the role of scientists, what's happening now with these, you know, very rare side effects of the AstraZeneca and probably also Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If you think at what the politicians, the leaders said, based on some numbers provided by the public health agency, well, there is nothing to be seen there. You know, thrombosis, you know, these you see every day, everywhere, and we look at the numbers, it's just the same. And it's because you had very clever scientists, MD, who were really impressed by the fact that some of these thrombotic events were really unusual. They said, I never saw such a case with a thrombosis in the brain or with low platelet count. There is something strange there, and it reminds me very other very rare cases caused by, you know, some drugs, whatever. But you have to know that because those scientists, you know, went to explore this, that nowadays we know that there is a link. And as you know, the link translates into some action in terms of identifying population for which, you know, some vaccines will not be used, as you know. So I think that really from the very beginning, and scientists have done their job. And I would say that this fuels my optimism, if I may say. I think that it's through science that, you know, this pandemic will end. And I think that's a major difference probably with wars, because, you know, in a war, you have the leader, they decide, you know, and they made peace together, and that's it. Here, I think that really it will come from science, and that's a key point. Now, what's interesting to see is the hurdles for science to deliver. And indeed, when you see what has been done in order to translate science into, you know, progress against the pandemic. Well, you know all the problems that we had. And I think that there's been really an underestimation of key elements. For example, you know, people were thinking, okay, we will have vaccines, so we are done. And then they realized that actually you cannot say to the industry, okay, we are waiting for you, and what will be the price of your vaccines, and let's negotiate. That's not how it should work. You know, to win this war, you need the private partners, you need the industry, but you need to discuss with them, how will we do this together? And again, perhaps it's interesting to compare what has been the role of industry during the war and how the dialogue has been organized with the politicians. But I think that here, and I hope that at the end of the pandemic, indeed, we will revise the way the public and the private work together. And if you look at the European Commission, I mean, it's really a disaster. They had just one thing in mind, is to have a good price for their vaccines. That was their main concern. Now, I must say that Europe is organized in such a way that it's true that the European Commission has not much power outside this, because the power is within the member states. And when you see what's happening now, you know, I'm really a vibrant European, but you know, sometimes I look what is happening now in UK, it's quite great what the situation, when I compare the situation in Belgium or even, I'm afraid, in France. And I think that the impact of science, the way science is used, should indeed be revisited. Now, the problem is that some, I would say, political actions and even, I would say, public health action, in a way, make the life of scientists more difficult. Because to develop a vaccine is one thing, but after that, I mean, people have to agree to be vaccinated. And when you see how, you know, the leaders, the politicians, deal with, you know, the vaccines and the way, I mentioned the European Commission, but I think that there are other examples to be given, the way indeed the question, for example, in Europe, people said, you know, AstraZeneca vaccine is a very good vaccine, but we are not sure that in all people it will work. So fine, so we don't give, at least in our countries, AstraZeneca to older people. And you know that a few months later, we are just doing the opposite. How do you want the lay people understand it and adhere to what you mentioned, herd immunity? To achieve herd immunity, you need obviously public confidence. And now it's, you know, very, I don't know how we will restore the confidence of the public. And it's really sad because, you know, the scientific tools are there. And I think that this question of adhesion, that's probably also a major difference with war. I think during the war, people see the enemy, they know who are the bad guys. Let's do it together. We are together to fight the enemy. And here you don't have that for a number of reasons. I think Laura mentioned, you don't see the enemy. But more than that, if you are a young adult, you don't understand, you see. But, you know, I have many, many friends and they were diagnosed positive, but you know, they don't have any symptoms or they just have like a flu for a few days. So what's this story that these things are? And this is really a problem in terms of, you know, maintaining and ensuring the unity of the population, which is so critical. And then obviously this gives argument to the real enemy right now. Who are the real enemies now? I think that they are the anti-vax. Those people, the complotists, those are really putting us in danger, not only to, you know, for the pandemic. At the end, we will solve. It might take 1 year more, 2 years more, but, you know, as I said, I'm optimistic. But what will happen after in terms of the political situation? And you know, I think in France, there are already, you know, some indication that Marine Le Pen might really take advantage of this. So I think that this is, you know, those are considerations that perhaps are a bit forgotten, and that's why it is so important to really try to restore the trust. And personally, I think that there is only one way, is really to build on science and also to find the right channels and the right people to convince the population that there are good things also done. And the point I would like to make, perhaps to end, and we can discuss it further after, it's about the children. I think that's probably my main concern today. Perhaps you saw that there are recent studies showing that, you know, autist-like traits are appearing more and more in the children population, social interaction. Well, this could have been anticipated. But, you know, this will be also the long-term consequences. You know, these people, how they will be in 10 years. I mean, it's not long COVID, but it might have much worse consequences even than long COVID. And what for me is really critical, and I'm trying to work on this, and actually Laura helped me by writing a short paper, really for children, trying to make children, as I said, you know, pandemic savvy. You know, there is a very nice German psychologist, his name is Giger Renzer, who is, you know, writing about, you know, how to be health savvy. I don't know what's exactly the title of his book, but it's very well explained that you have to start very early on to explain people what health means and how you can take care of your health. And this you can do even in young children. I think that this is one of the important mission of school and obviously inside the family. And, you know, it's complicated right now because, you know, at the beginning we were saying, yeah, it's like flu, you know, these young kids are transmitting the virus. Now we say, no, they don't. They can go back to school, and then still you have cases, and the children themselves, they are confused in a way. They are, I don't know if this is an English word. Do you say culpabilisé?
You know, I feel guilty.
Yeah. And so your grandparents, you will make them sick and all the, and they don't understand. And I think that's for me one of the top priority. And again, well, I'm not a historian like you, but I think that it would be interesting to compare the situation of children during wars, with also a number of, you know, important disturbances, and now. And there might be similarities, but I guess also major differences, because I think that it's the same for the children. It's even more difficult to understand what the pandemic means, what this virus means. And I think that this might be just some elements for discussion. So, well, I'm perhaps sorry, it's a bit all over the place, but these are just elements I just tried to build upon what I heard. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. Fascinating discussion possibilities. But I'm going to turn it over to Paula before we open it up for discussion.
Yeah, thank you. Again, thank you for inviting me and for the great discussions from the other speakers, too. I think what I will be talking about will pull on a lot of those themes as well, so it'll be really good for the discussion after this. As Michael mentioned at the start, my expertise is in the history of vaccination, and especially the history of anti-vaccination movements and vaccine hesitancy. And vaccines occupy a very significant space in modern medical conception of the end of a pandemic, especially the end of epidemics and disease. It's very profoundly optimistic. They hold in them the potential, the promise of endings, the ending of infection, the ending of corresponding human suffering caused by an infection. And the conversations in 2020 have starkly emphasized this essentiality of the vaccine will be playing, the way that the vaccine plays in the public imagination of the end of the pandemic. At a press conference on December 2nd, when Boris Johnson announced the approval of the Pfizer vaccine, he said, "We are no longer resting on the mere hope that we can return to normal next year in the spring, but rather the sure and certain knowledge that we will succeed and together reclaim our lives and all the things about our lives that we love." Now, the history of vaccination demonstrates that vaccines seldom provide this clean, quick, and beautiful ending to an infectious outbreak. Rather, the introduction of vaccination is a new type of beginning. It's the beginning of the complicated and very difficult task of securing vaccinations en masse across the populace. And there's many barriers, not just the scientific, logistical, financial, policy barriers, of course, that come hand in hand with generating, organizing access to vaccines, but also the social and political and ideological barriers that shape perceptions of vaccine programs and vaccines themselves. Ultimately, rather than securing an alluring return to all the things about our lives that we love, vaccination programs, when implemented during an epidemic or a pandemic, are almost always very tumultuous and divisive. They reveal the underlying inequities and fissures within a society, and they're far more unsettling than they are alleviating. I want to stop before I move on here to talk about the difference between vaccine hesitancy and anti-vaccination. And I'll be using both those terms while I'm speaking, so I just wanted to clarify what the difference is there. When I speak about vaccine hesitancy, I am simply referring to professed fear, distrust, or concern about getting a vaccine. This does not necessarily imply that someone is against vaccination or will not eventually choose to receive a vaccine. However, it does reflect an inherent anxiety around vaccination itself. And it's often very individual, connected to identity and personal experience. Anti-vaccination, on the other hand, is being used, I will refer to it as specifically the purposeful spread of disinformation or provocative content that is actively meant to influence people against vaccination. This can take many forms. In the past, it was usually through public notices, pamphlets, postcard campaigns, public speeches and lectures quite often, or protests as well. And today it's usually involving social media campaigning and online content. And these are not distinct groups by any means. Most anti-vaccination activists are also vaccine hesitant themselves, but not all vaccine hesitant individuals are actively anti-vaccination. And that's really important to make a distinction there. However, the convergence of these two groups has often occurred during times of heightened vaccination programs, usually after policy or legislation is passed that coerces or enforces vaccine programs. And the strongest waves of anti-vaccination sentiment have always followed on the heels of mandatory policies in the past. Compulsory policies are disproportionately felt by those who already have good reasons to be suspicious of established institutions, often marginalized communities and minorities in a population. And anti-vaccinationists use this moment to target vaccine-hesitant communities with propaganda and disinformation and exponentially grow their own followings and their own power within conversations about vaccines. So I'm going to give an example of how this happened in the past. I'm going to point to an epidemic that happened in the city of Montreal in 1885. This is a really good example of not just a major epidemic, but also how anti-vaccination narratives can take hold of a population and mobilize it against vaccination. So in 1885, Montreal experienced a very devastating smallpox epidemic. By official counts, there was over 9,600 cases of infection, nearly 4,000 deaths. And this is about 2% of the city's population itself, so it's quite a large number. The majority of cases occurred amongst the French working class communities, especially in the low-income areas of the city on Montreal's East End. And when cases began to increase, alarmingly, the city health officials implemented a compulsory vaccination program across the city. So it began by setting up public vaccination points where people could show up and get their vaccines. But they found that very few French speakers in the city were actually showing up for vaccinations. And so they started to go door to door across the communities to enforce vaccination, often with policemen, et cetera. Now, alongside this was a targeted effort by anti-vaccination activists to encourage resistance to the vaccines. One man in particular stood out in this movement. His name was Dr. Alexander Ross. He was a very wealthy English-speaking physician who very much viewed himself as a moral crusader. He saw himself as a savior of the less fortunate and oppressed individuals. And because he knew he was working with mostly French-speaking vaccine-hesitant communities, he had most of his pamphlets translated into French, and he worked with another French physician as well in the city, whose name was Emery Coder, to do this. And they distributed it across many of the neighborhoods. But he also knew that a lot of his communities that he was trying to target were illiterate. So he started to write songs even that they could learn to sing. And these songs were always about him riding in as literally a white knight, the savior of the people, to save them from the fetish and the brainwashing of vaccination. And he said very similar arguments to what you'll see today. He claimed that vaccinations were simply a way for doctors to make money, that they were poisonous and they were harmful. He claimed that smallpox, the threat of smallpox itself was minimal. It was overemphasized, and that vaccines themselves were killing more people than the smallpox epidemic was. And as health inspectors went door to door, they started to meet incredible resistance, not just silence and resentment, but actual conflict. They were attacked with knives in some neighborhoods and physically dragged out of homes. And the people were always usually the French class, working class, that was believing this was it was an attempt by medical authorities to continue, you know, increasing their own power and to oppress the French-speaking community in the city. The city itself was starkly divided. Most elites, politicians, and physicians were Anglophone. Almost all the vaccinators themselves were Anglophone, whereas the communities they're going to, of course, are the Francophone classes. Now, the resistance reached a peak in September 28th, 1885, which was the day an anti-vaccination riot broke out across the city. Some French-speaking men stormed the city hall where most of the vaccinations had been taking place. They destroyed the windows, threw rocks at it. They moved on to the city vaccinators' houses, onto the physician houses. English-speaking newspapers were attacked, and they congregated in the city center and climbed on the statue of Queen Victoria and started singing songs about how the French should rule the city and that the English were responsible for the misery and the death of that year. So this really changed from an anti-vaccination resistance to, as you can tell, like a French revolutionary resistance against the oppressive forces in their city. Eventually, the crowd was subdued, but the tensions didn't disappear. And until at least the next year, there was still always continuous threat of more riots. And when infections declined, vaccine enforcement policies also declined. And that's generally when the police squads were recalled, because there's less unrest in the city. Now, Alexander Ross is not a unique figure in history. He rather represents an archetype of an anti-vaccination leader. Figures like Ross have periodically risen to prominence on the backs of different anti-vaccination movements, usually in the times of outbreak. Ross was in 1885, but in 1900, there was another outbreak in most of northern, eastern North America. And Benedict Lust, who's the father of naturopathy, he became an anti-vaccination leader at that time and really helped to promote his concept of medicine, naturopathy, which started to take off after that. In 1923, there was another outbreak on the West Coast, and a man named Alfred McKay Jordan, who called himself an energician of alternative electrical medicine, he rose to prominence on the back of an anti-vaccination movement. And prominent astrologist in 1927, Ada Murr, she rose to prominence on the back of anti-vaccination narratives during an enforcement of smallpox vaccine in 1927. And today we have the so-called disinformation dozen, who are continuing this pattern, actively targeting minority populations in their attempts to inflame vaccine hesitancy into full anti-vaccination movements. The disinformation dozen were labeled by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And they are 12 individuals. And in a report recently by that center, they are responsible for over 65% of all online anti-vaccination content. It comes from just 12 individuals. So it really shows you how singular individuals are really in power when it comes to inflaming and creating these misinformation narratives. However, it's also important to recognize the role of mainstream medicine in these processes as well. It's not just anti-vaccinationists who target vulnerable populations. Medical policy and medical voices have often shown a disregard for vaccine hesitancy and the concerns of minority voices. And vaccine implementation strategies often demonstrate intrinsic prejudice and racism as well. So I'll give you an example of that, which was in 1900 in San Francisco during a scare of plague. In San Francisco in 1900, in March, there was one or two cases of diagnosed plague in the city's Chinatown. And the city health officials originally began by quarantining Chinatown and later implementing a regulation that all Chinese citizens had to be vaccinated with the half-kind plague vaccine. Now, this vaccine was quite new at the time. It had been shown to be quite effective at protecting individuals against plague in India, and it was generally shown to be safe, although there were some incidents of cross-contamination with tetanus and other diseases. However, the actions of the health board were seen as a plan to eradicate Chinese settlement in the city once and for all. And Chinese citizens had very good reasons to be afraid of this, because only a few months before that, Chinatown in Honolulu had just been completely burned to the ground as a result of the sanitation actions of health officials who had similarly been trying to eradicate plague and had ended up burning down all of Chinatown. So city health officials in San Francisco implemented a regulation based solely on race for vaccination. And eventually the Chinese community organized a protest against this, marched in anger against it, and had it overturned in a court of law. And it's the very first event in America where a judge rules health regulations cannot be implemented based on race. However, that same year, just north of San Francisco in Vancouver, Chinese and Japanese populations were also the only communities required to be smallpox vaccinated when there was an outbreak of smallpox in that city. And Chinese communities are not the only communities targeted by medical policies in the past, especially with regards to vaccination. Over the next 50 years, you see both Indigenous and Black populations across North America serving as test subjects in a number of medical experiments, including during the development of the BCG, tuberculosis vaccine, the polio vaccines, rubella vaccines. And today we are seeing with COVID a replication of similar racial divides in how vaccination is rolled out. There's been a consistent pattern across the United States of Black and Hispanic people receiving smaller as well as compared to their share of the total population. Vaccine hesitancy is heightened in racialized communities in the United States, in Canada, and the United Kingdom. And globally, access to vaccines has been weighted heavily in favor of wealthy Western countries. These are just, I want to share actually here quickly some images from some anti-vaccination communities. Let me just do this. Some anti-vaccination websites. So let me just, actually, I'll do that. I'll get to the slide. So if you go on an anti-vaccination website, there's some very well-known ones. You will generally be greeted with their first image they want to show you. And right now, these are the images on three different anti-vaccination websites in America. These images here are very much speaking to the current racial divides in vaccines and trying to target individuals who have very good reasons to discuss vaccine hesitancy and to be suspicious of programs and the way that they're rolled out. When viewed with a critical eye, you can see that the history of vaccination campaigns reveals that resistance to vaccines are often stemming from the fact that concerns about vaccine hesitancy are not treated with enough respect, and that vaccine hesitancy is often seen as just another disease to be cured. And that's where we are at the end of, well, towards the end of this. And it's one of the reasons why vaccines are really never truly the ending to an epidemic or pandemic, but the beginning of recognizing how these inequalities are reproduced over and over. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paula, and thank you so much to all the speakers. And I will encourage everyone once again to put questions into the chat box, and I'll kind of aggregate them, and then we'll go to work. I wanted to start, as people are thinking and considering questions, I was fascinated by this issue of children, I'll go to that next. But just in terms of an overarching question, it was something that Laura tripped on, which I thought was fascinating. And it's this question of the Spanish flu, how we name wars, the Iraq War, the Vietnam or the American War, the Chinese virus, and how issues of nationalism come into play. Is this an attempt to kind of fight an enemy that's not clear incorrectly? Is this also a part of kind of an anti-vax propaganda idea in terms of building public trust through naming of another. And that was something that Michael talked about. So maybe if I could ask you each to ruminate on the question and just come in.
Well, maybe I'll kick off just with the idea of naming, because of the Spanish flu being one of the very few certainties we have about it is that it wasn't Spanish or it didn't start in Spain. But what's interesting is that it kind of dovetails with the timing issue, because it attracted that name when the first cases occurred in Madrid in May of 1918, and they were reported upon because Spain was neutral, so it didn't censor its press, unlike some of the belligerent countries which had the disease earlier but didn't report it in their newspapers. So supposedly not so as not to lower the morale of their populations. So that anchors the start of the pandemic in the popular consciousness at May 1918, but it had been raging for some time already. And in the end, I think it just comes back to this issue of how we tell stories, how we package history and events and reality into stories, and the kind of reality gap between those things. And yes, it of course then goes on to shape our behavior, including who we think is responsible for the disease, where we think the solutions should come from. I don't know, maybe Paula has some data on this, whether there's relatively more vaccine hesitancy towards the Chinese vaccine, Sinovac, or to others, or, you know, if this dovetails in with nationalism at that level today.
Thank you so much.
I'm sorry, perhaps I'll jump in just to respond directly to also what Laura mentioned. So on the concept of whether there's more hesitancy towards specific vaccines, what Michelle had mentioned earlier is very true on the way in which hesitancy is now shaped around the AstraZeneca vaccine, especially because of the flip-flopping with policy based on, you know, the evidence that came forward over time. But it's very difficult to determine whether or not there's hesitancy towards, for instance, the Sino vaccine, because it's just not employed across the West. And you'd have to look within the areas that it is employed to look for that. And unfortunately, it's not my area, so I'm not really certain on how that is. But I think it will, in a year, become a very big conversation when vaccinations, usually when we have the rollout programs for vaccines, you have a few competing vaccines and it sort of settles down to the one or two that eventually people decide upon. And I think we'll see a lot of vaccine nationalism coming forward in when and how people decide upon vaccines when they have the access to all of them and when they make choices in the next year or so about which vaccine they would like to choose rather than which one is being offered because it's the only one currently in offer. And I really like what you said about the importance of personal narratives, Laura, because this is also what Mary had mentioned at the beginning on how that story and the way a story is told is very key to the politics and the conception of when something has begun or ended. And in lots of ways, that's the same in how vaccines are talked about in the past and currently. We learn about our information about vaccines not always from the sources that we'd hope would be the ones teaching us about vaccines, being our scientists who are speaking to us, but we learn about vaccine and vaccine experience through our social networks always. And we always have in the past. Those social networks were based upon our identity of an English speaker, a French speaker in Montreal, or a person who's white or Chinese in San Francisco. But it's very much about who you know and what their experiences are, and it's shaped communally like that. And so working very significantly with community leaders and communities is really key to going forward in this, because that is how people always will weigh their evidence, because that personal story is so important.
If I could jump in, and let me just say, I just so appreciated everyone's remarks, and Paula, your research on anti-vaxxers is just so interesting and important, disturbing and important. Let me just sort of jump in, just as a minor little tweak to the important point about social networks. To say that, you know, when it comes to sort of the naming question that Victoria started us with, elites do play can play a significant role, which then I would think sort of feeds into sort of the sort of pre-existing social networks. And so then, you know, as an American, I have to mention sort of he who should not be named, our last president, who you know, in speeches would cross out the word and sort of call it the Chinese virus. So an attempt to, you know, and there what you have is a leader who uses a crisis as a way of fomenting divisions for his because he needed something to sort of fill in to fit into and help to fuel his pre-existing, you know, political approach and narrative and his networks, right? And so, you know, again, I do think that this helps us to see, you know, at least when you have a demagogue, the way that someone can, then an elite who has a strong voice and an ability to gain access to the public sphere can play an important role in the sort of racialization of a public health narrative.
Thank you. Michelle.
Yes, perhaps a few comments starting from vaccine hesitancy and then switching to nationalism. The first thing I would like to say is that, you know, vaccine hesitancy, this is something which is natural. You know, too often I hear I am pro-vaccine, I am for the vaccine, or you have the anti, I am again. I think that's not the point. I think that it's very natural that you ask questions to yourselves or to doctors. I think the problem is not the hesitancy, is the way we address the hesitancy. And I think that there, at least that's my personal viewpoint, you should not be afraid to tell what you know, and not to say, well, this I will not say because otherwise they will be afraid. And I think that we have still to learn how to communicate and to answer questions. This is about vaccine safety. But then you mentioned the Chinese vaccines. I would say I understand. I would not like to get the Chinese vaccine because simply it's less efficient. The data are there. So it's not a question. It's not because it is Chinese. It's just because it is less efficient. Now, it's true that people could then exploit this. And you will see what will happen with the Sputnik vaccine. The Russian, I think that he will soon enter in the same debate than the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson, because it's just the same technology. And then we will see how people react. Now, what's interesting is that it's true that there are those geopolitical dimensions. But there, coming back to your question of, you know, comparing with the war times, you know, the point, and this is obvious for everyone, I mean, this is a fight for the whole world. And we know that we will not end the pandemic if there are still some regions in the world where the virus can circulate, because it will come back to us. So that's why we are now, and it's true that with the Biden election, there is hope again that multilateralism and organizations like WHO will, you know, be empowered, I would say. But that's really, but I agree that today nationalism is there. And again, I will speak about Europe because this is what I know. I think it's really tragic that we are not able to align ourselves about simply, you know, which is the right age to start to use this vaccine. 60 in some countries, 30 in others, 55, 50. How would you like to explain that people are confident? It's the same virus, we are the same people, and the vaccines are the same. Why this difference? Especially in Europe, because we are supposed to get the same number of vaccines depending on our population. So what's the rationale for these differences? You know, there are no treatments for immunocompromised patients, which seem to work. They are approved in the United States. In Europe, they are still not approved. So what happened is that each country, that's nationalism, put his own role, and now you can get those treatments in France or in Germany, but not in Belgium. And, you know, people, they are on the social networks, they realize all this. And I think that there is really a responsibility now to try to be, yeah, indeed, coherent and to understand that nationalism is really counterproductive, even inside the country, when you say, okay, look how good we are. But, you know, at the end of the day, we will be good together. And that's something that I think there is really a need for. I don't know. I know that I think in May there is a G20 meeting, which is supposed to talk about these things and to try to see especially how we can help low and middle income country with vaccines. But I agree that nationalism is a real threat.
Thank you so much. I wanted to go back to your comments about children, because I think that, you know, the impact on social groups and class groups is really profound in wartime and in pandemics, as both you and Laura have spoken about specifically. And so if you would each talk a little bit about the implications of a non-ending or a lack of a final moment an abrupt moment, war, pandemic, children, as you said, women have been certainly in the workforce have been deeply affected, race and ethnic divisions we've spoken about, but obviously, you know, education and economic disparities growing, long-term implications. If you could each address that would be terrific.
If no one else is going to dive in, I could get the ball rolling. I was just thinking that when I was writing about memory for pandemics in my book, I spoke to some psychologists who think about collective memory. One of the phenomena that I learned about was something called the reminiscence bump, which is the idea that people remember most the things that happened to them in their sort of adolescence, early adulthood, and that these events become the sort of formative events of their lives and shape in a way their behavior and their reactions going forward. And it's because new generations are coming through all the time that sort of collective memory gets updated, that the kind of the bump, the formative events change all the time. Thank goodness. But so you could say that baby boomers are most, you know, in America would be most affected perhaps by the death of the murder of JFK or the Vietnam War, and then the later generations by the election of President Obama and 9/11 and so on. And these are the things that shape how we respond to events going forward. And I think that so probably it would be reasonable to argue, at least, that people who are in that age group, adolescents, young adults now, will be the ones who are most likely to remember this event, this phenomenon, this pandemic, and perhaps to respond to it if society responds. Because I mean, one of the things that causes public health experts to despair and tear their hair out is that they think we go through this sort of cycle of what they call, you know, panic and complacency, that we forget the pandemic as soon as it's passed, and then we panic and the next one comes along, when actually they are periodic events that, you know, we can't predict exactly when they'll happen, but we do know there will be future ones. There will almost certainly be at least another one in this century. So, you know, I think it's interesting that there's a lot of talk at the moment about how the children are have really been so badly affected by this pandemic and how they've been traumatized and how they have suffered and sort of borne the brunt of the measures designed to contain it. And also they're the ones who are most likely to remember, you know, will they be the ones who insist we all wear masks, you know, in the metro in the future? Will they drive behavioral change? Will they be the ones who elect politicians or stand as politicians who will invest in pandemic preparedness and so on? So, just some thoughts on how the children might take this experience forward and shape our behavior afterwards.
Thank you.
I may just simply add to this that I think that the generation you are talking about, I think that they will probably make a link, or at least in their memory, there will be the pandemic, but I think it will be closely linked to the climate change issue. And for a number of reasons, including the role of climate change in the emergence of pandemic, but that's another issue. But I think they will remember this as a failure of the governance. I mean, you know, we were seeing this virus, we were, you know, at least so far unable to manage it. And I think that we will still have to live with the virus and at least with some constraints for, I guess, years personally. And also they will say, okay, you know, these people who are in the lead, they were not able to manage the pandemic the right way, and they were not able to manage climate change. So they were not able to anticipate and to prepare our future. So what will be the consequence, whether they will say, no, we will do things differently, I don't know, but I think that their memories towards the people who are currently in the lead will be really extremely critical, especially that we don't see worldwide any figure, you know, taking a position which can, you know, be where especially the young people can recognize themselves. We don't have a Kennedy, even we don't have an Obama, or nowhere. We don't see where is this person. Probably Macron would like to be this one, but I don't think that so far he succeeded.
Just if I can add a couple of thoughts on this. I mean, on some level, perhaps given the recent experience in the United States, maybe it should be a sigh of relief that someone hasn't emerged who can sort of be the unifying cultural voice, because it could be a cultural voice of extremism. I think that that Michelle is absolutely right that there were going to be profound impacts downstream politically. I think it's hard really to sort of map that out at this point. It's hard for us to see that. I just wanted to say about children, one of the most profound impacts on the younger generation of the pandemic is the loss of education. So, in the United States, the profound educational deficits and the great class-based differences where some families hire tutors for groups of young students to try to do online learning together, and other parents driving to the parking lot of a Burger King hamburger stand so that they can try to hook into the internet of the hamburger shop so that the child can do a little bit of schoolwork. And really, some children have simply lost a year of schooling, and it's going to be difficult to know how to build up on that, not only their education, but also the sort of social and cultural dimensions of the isolation and loss. So I think that, you know, we really are going to need our public policy and education policy experts, childhood experts on childhood, to think very seriously about how to positively work on empowering and building up this next generation of of young people. So that's my response to the important question about children.
Thank you so much, Paula.
Yeah, children have been a really mobilizing force across a lot of times in epidemics and pandemic narratives. Just the image of the dying child, especially polio. And children have played, an imagined role quite often, as well as a real one, in tuberculosis, especially especially Indigenous reserves. Like the image of the dying tuberculosis child too is another one. And I wonder, and I'm worried about the way in which the differences in experience between different communities, especially racialized communities versus, you know, white communities across North America, will regulate how children experience this long term, because there will be some who remember this year as the year at home, the year of like no school in person, lack of friends, probably social isolation. But there'll be some who remember it as the year of multiple murders of Black individuals across the United States and their loss of huge amounts of family members from COVID, from very marginalized communities who were very adversely affected by it. And in the case of tuberculosis in Canada, a lot of the Indigenous children who experienced the continued tuberculosis infections on Indigenous reserves, often spread through schools, you have long legacies of intergenerational trauma and very, very traumatic experiences of healthcare and what it meant to be treated and what it meant to be part of you know, eradication programs for tuberculosis, and just how traumatizing that could be, the loss of family, the loss of culture that went ahead and went with that. And we have seen loss of culture and loss of family amongst many children's experiences too. So maybe I'm a little bit more pessimistic and I'm worried about what that long-term effect will be, because it's going to be, I think, quite a traumatizing one for many children, especially from communities that were very adversely affected.
Thank you so much. We have about 5 more minutes, and I know I'd like to hand the mic over to Michael, because I know that he wanted to put in our final question. So, Michael, would you come in?
Thank you very much indeed, Victoria. I was reading a report from a Dr. Brumage of the University of Massachusetts, which he published on the 6th of May 2020. And I thought his messaging, because my concern is about the gravity and the clarity of messaging that's been given. This afternoon, the panel's been perfect in their messaging. And I think Laura, in her book, was talking about clarity of messaging as one of the key factors in tackling the pandemics and things. And my concern was that in Dr. Brumage's report, and I think this should have been known pretty worldwide, he says this, which is rather stark message. If a person coughs or sneezes, those 200 million viral particles go everywhere. So we're talking about going back to school, going back to classrooms, going back to lectures and so forth. We've got issues in my university, et cetera, and elsewhere. And 200 million viral particles, I don't think that's commonly known. Some virus hangs in the air. Some falls into surfaces. Most falls to the ground. So if you're face to face with a person having a conversation and that person sneezes or coughs straight at you, it's pretty easy to see how it is possible to inhale 1,000 virus particles and become infected. Now, that's a very stark message, which you all understand. I don't think the general public here understands it. But my concern is, I spoke to a nuclear scientist, he's a relation of mine, and I said to him, well, can't we reduce this viral spread by when we wear a mask? But he said, no mask will stop these particles getting into you. Do you think at all they can invent some sort of mask that does prevent you getting some of those minor particles? Is that possible, or is that just a fiction? Do we have to wear a mask plus a face shield or something? I just wonder whether that would be a good step forward. I mean, assuming that Michelle is absolutely right, I agree with everything he said, that this pandemic will be with us. It's endemic. It will last for a long time. And we will have to take these steps of distancing and wearing masks. Is it a good idea that they could invent something a bit more practical, a bit more effective? I just posed the point. But I don't think, generally speaking, may underline, the general public understand this point about 200 million viral particles. Too horrific, but
You know, it's funny because this is where Michael and I started out, and maybe I'll ask Mary to come in first because I know that she has another appointment. And I was in Japan in February, giving a book talk, and one of the professors at the University of Tokyo said, "Oh, the mask is a meme." What are the implications of the fact that we all take our shoes off at airports because somebody tried to light their shoe on fire after 9/11? Maybe we could wrap up with kind of a reflection on masks and memes and other social implications.
So let me just say, Michael, you've made it so clear that breath is really terrifying, isn't it? And this is really the problem. It's not just coughing and sneezing, although I'll always remember those 200 million particles, which unfortunately can sort of, back to Laura's, the way that people get targeted, you can imagine sort of fights everywhere, not just on the school ground, in the airport and everywhere. And or a move to continually isolate ourselves because basically breath is dangerous. Don't we need a counter move rather than the construction of more effective barriers? Don't we need to be able to, breath has always been dangerous, right? The virus doesn't introduce something new in that way. Although breath is in this era more dangerous and dangerous in specific ways. I mean, I think I'll never teach without a mask on inside a small classroom without windows and no air circulation. I mean, that's my seminar room, oversubscribed, packed, and everyone breathing and coughing upon each other. And at least during flu season right now, it's hard for me to imagine being in that room for 2 hours without having a good mask on, but not sort of like a knight in shining armor, sort of covered, because then social life is forever fractured. Because we need to be able to hug again, and we need to be able to touch each other again in obviously appropriate ways, and we need to be able to sort of rebuild social life. And on some level, the rebuilding of social life is a precondition for politics, for economics, and for everything that flows after that to develop in a healthy way. So I think what we ultimately need is a way to be able to breathe without fear, understanding that we're breathing on each other, and that's what humans do. And that's what we need to be able to do in the future. So I think that's my last comment, because unfortunately I have to be somewhere else in New York, even though I'm in Rhode Island. But I really love this conversation, and thank you so much for including me. And I'm sorry I have to skip out.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary. Who else would like to come in?
Well, I understand what has been said. I think so, at least. I think that when you alluded, to this huge number of particles, the way it is transmitted rather easily, and the need for mask and protection, I think at the same time you should think and talk about about vaccines and about the fact that we will have the tool to protect, hopefully, the majority of us. So things are going all together. And at the end, my hope, because this is something which is, in my view, but that's a personal view, lacking. I think that now we say to people, you have to do this because this is a collective effort. So you have to take the vaccine, even if probably you will never be sick, but you have to protect the others. And the same can be said for the mask and all these things, which is obviously true. But what I hope is that at some point, even if the virus is still there, the level of protection will be such that indeed people will be able to make their choice. And they might say, okay, I don't want all these, and I take the risk, and that's it. And if they come sick, like, it's true for the flu, huh? You have young people dying from flu, well, not this year, but the year before. So I think that we have to reach a point where people can make their own decision without the pressure and their own decision from what they know and from their personal situation. And I don't know how it is in UK or in France, but in Belgium, it's just incredible. You know, there is no dialogue between the person, the patient, and the GP about, you know, what do you think? And, you know, it's unbelievable. Every day I receive a number of calls, mails, and I'm wondering, but why they don't discuss this with their GP? Because, you know, even for vaccines, to give a good advice, you need to know the story of this person. Perhaps you have to check a number of things to look at their medical files and all these things. And I think that what's really important, and I think this is a problem in the current situation, is that we lose this, you know, personal relation, this dialogue. And perhaps I will end with that because, you know, well, we all have, you know, the people that we admire in history. I have two. One is a Nobel laureate in medicine. His name was Jules Bordet. He was at the time where, you know, the diphtheria and all these pandemics, and they developed the serotherapy, you know, when, you know, you had these horses and you took the serum of the horse and you saved, you know, thousands of children. And I was always wondering, what would this guy do today, you know, like Pasteur, things like that. It's and that's one. But the point I would like to end with is another person that you, if you don't know him, you should look at his aphorism. His name is William Osler. Do you know this person? So this is, and I can tell you, you know, I have on my, you know, every week I read again what this guy wrote about medicine, about how a good physician should behave. And for me, this is really lacking today. And when I see some of the decisions that are taken by even the politicians, sometimes I say, okay, it's not the minister which will give you the jab. Huh? You have to discuss this with your doctor, and you never know what can happen. And I think that this dimension, I mean, it's not directly the point you was raising, but I think it's still linked, is important.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Paula?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Michael, that you raised, and just on the idea of the kind of long-term social implications and culture and how that can change. There was, in the early 1900s, a trend that developed across Canada and major cities in the US, where after smallpox outbreaks happened and children got vaccinated, especially in schools en masse, they started to wear like a band around their arm, a white band and a red band, depending on which city it was, which was called the vaccine band, because quite often vaccination scars, because it took 2 weeks for a smallpox scar to actually heal, they could get infected, especially from tetanus and other, you know, environmental pollutants. So there was this fear, you know, if you didn't cover it up and you didn't wear it over your sleeve, people might knock into you in public. You might have someone get too close. They could hurt your vaccine and cause a complication. And so it became a trend to put on a vaccine band when you got vaccinated. And that became a social signal of some sort that you were vaccinated. You were not just vaccinated, but you were currently at risk of someone hitting you. So please stay away from my arm. Keep your distance. It's a very social distancing signal. And then also it got worked into fashion. So I think one of the most interesting cases is that quite often women's dresses started to adopt the vaccine band to be stylized off of, like, how you could have a very fashionable dress while you were wearing your vaccine band. I think that's a really interesting one because it lasted for a long time too. It continued on fashion trends up into the 1920s until the 1930s rolled around. And I think people dropped the style, but I think that was one of the most interesting long-term changes in social aspects. I could see masks having a similar impact. Perhaps we'll have a small mask, but we all have our colorful masks when we're out and about. When you wear a mask, it's a bit of a signal, like, please don't come too close to me because I'm concerned about our distance. And it's also a way that you can, you know, create, you know, have an excuse for crossing the street really quickly in front of a car if you have to get away from someone. You know, there's reasons why it has a social signal. So I can see that being a long-term one.
Thank you. Laura, I'm going to give you the final word.
Oh, thank you very much, Vicky. Well, I have a funny story that follows on from Paula's, which is that there was quite a strong anti-smoking movement in some parts of, let's say, the richer world in right up to the beginning of the 1918 pandemic, which kind of collapsed in the pandemic because people had this idea, reinforced by some doctors, that smoking could protect you against the flu. And so smoking takes off in the 1920s, becomes really trendy, and women take it up. And so, okay, there's an example of bad comms. But of course, they didn't know for a long time to come that smoking was so bad for you. But I think, you know, it does, for me, a lot of it comes back to communication. And I think I'm slightly cheating in not directly answering Michael's question, but there is so much information out there, and there's so much misinformation out there, and there's also so much uncertainty out there. So just to take the issue of masks, we still don't really know. We know that broadly they work, but we don't know where, when, for whom, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty even in that one small sort of sub-debate. And, you know, public health experts kind of tackle this kind of uncertainty by adopting the precautionary principle, which is that, you know, if the cost is not too high and the benefit is probably good, then, you know, adopt it. So what I think is really interesting is that that's their idea. So right from the beginning, without knowing very much about COVID, they started to promote mask use. But it's not an idea necessarily that the public understands. So the public are going to focus on the uncertainty. So what I wondered might be a solution to that would be, in between pandemics, before the next one comes, if we can have a kind of whole of society debate that brings everybody in about how are we going to react when it first appears, because we won't know anything about this disease and we won't know what works and what doesn't work. Would it be, what do you think about adopting the precautionary principle? For example, saying everybody should wear masks, even if we don't know how they work or to what extent. And I think to some extent, that's what's been missing when we've been having these simulations of how to deal with hypothetical pandemics, but the public are excluded from them. It's politicians, security people, doctors, of course, scientists, more recently business leaders, but community leaders aren't in on those simulations. So I think there's a kind of a communications work to be done before the next pandemic, maybe too late for this one. And just to finish on the issue of fake news and misinformation, which has been a massive problem, of course, in this pandemic, but it is always a problem in all pandemics. And to some extent, I think you can't eliminate it. But I think what's really interesting is that, you know, before the pandemic, there was a big discussion about how we give over a lot of our private information, for example, to the social media platforms. We don't get anything back for that information. They use it to their profit. And sometimes they even use it against us, as, for example, in the manipulation of the Brexit referendum and so on. Should there be more regulation of the way our information is used so that it is at least not used against us and could be used for our benefit? And I think that, you know, that was a discussion that was already underway before the pandemic because of Brexit, because of, you know, Russian interference in American elections and so on. I think that COVID will add another sense of, another push to that, another sense of urgency, because we've seen the public health dimension of what can go wrong when that happens too. So, you know, I think that, you know, pandemics tend to accelerate trends that are already there. And that's one trend I suspect that it will accelerate.
Thank you so much, Laura, and thank you to everyone. Thank you to all of our speakers, to our co-sponsors, and a very special thank you to Alice Bryant, who was our event coordinator. And let's give a hand clap to everyone. And thank you all so much for coming. We will have a video recording of this posted, and we look forward to sharing it with friends and colleagues. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.